This is Amarin's. It's Friday, June 8th, 2007, and today is the 20th anniversary of New Zealand becoming the world's first nuclear-free nation. Hi, everybody. This is Arthur, and welcome to episode 15 of my podcast. In the past, I've talked a little bit about New Zealand's nuclear-free status, but I thought today I would talk a little bit more about what it means to the nation in particular. But there's also a lot of catching up to do. It seems like forever since I last spoke to you, but that's mostly because I sort of got things screwed up in my head. I admit it. It was an incredibly dumb moment on my part. But what happened is that Nigel took Friday off. Monday was public holiday, the Queen's birthday holiday. And somewhere in that long weekend, my sense of what day it was got all mixed up. So I was thinking it was a day earlier than it really was. And so when I was getting ready to record the podcast, I suddenly realized it was already Wednesday. I didn't really have time to record, to be honest. And I thought, well, should I try to shove it into my schedule, or should I just wait? And I decided in the end to just wait. Now, that was made a little bit easier, because I knew that on Tuesday, I'd recorded with Tim Carmel for his personal podcast, There's Some Who Call Me Tim. And on Wednesday, I had recorded with Archer for his show, Archer Radio, which he posted on Wednesday, I guess it was. I get a little bit confused because of the time zones. And the days, apparently. Anyway, be that as it may, I'm going to catch up with a few things that I haven't been able to with these various breaks and disruptions and so on. But first, I do want to talk a bit about this whole nuclear thing. 20 years ago today, the New Zealand Parliament banned nuclear-powered and nuclear-propelled ships from New Zealand waters, and also, of course, nuclear weapons from New Zealand soil, not that we had any. And also, there's no nuclear power in New Zealand either, for that matter. This was a major bone of contention between New Zealand and the United States, as you might imagine, and the Reagan administration retaliated by suspending the ANZUS alliance, which is between New Zealand, Australia, and the United States. And it wasn't a very bright thing to do, as I've said in the past. It was actually against America's interests. But it's been argued that if the United States had responded with trade sanctions instead of military sanctions, that they actually would have succeeded in having the ban repealed. And I actually think that that's true, and here's why. A few years earlier, the French government had sent terrorists in to blow up the Rainbow Warrior in Auckland Harbor. And when that happened, it galvanized opinion in a lot of ways against the whole business of nuclear testing in the Pacific and also against nuclear weapons in general. But the terrorists that the French government sent, and they were apparently under the direct orders of the premier at the time, or president of the time, sorry, François Mitterrand. Anyway, they were fairly inept. In some ways, they were more like Inspector Clouseau than they were like, say, Jean Reno or somebody like that. Anyway, they were caught, basically, and they were tried, and they were convicted, and they were sentenced to prison. Now, that's as it should be. You know, you commit a crime, you do the time, all those sorts of things. Unlike Paris Hilton, of course, but that's another matter. So these terrorists were sitting in New Zealand jail, and France was not happy about this. They decided that they wanted the people back, and obviously the New Zealand government wasn't about to release them. So France told the government of the day, which was headed by Prime Minister David Lange, that if New Zealand didn't release the terrorists, that they would end New Zealand's trade with Europe. They would see to it that New Zealand wouldn't be able to trade with the emerging European Union. I think it was still called the Common Market in those days. But essentially, it was trade blackmail. So New Zealand had no choice. As a small trading nation on the edge of the world, it couldn't afford to lose the entire European market, on principle, even. So they struck a deal with the French government to transfer custody to them, let them finish out their terms in one of the French colonies in the South Pacific. Well, they were there, I think, a few months, and then the French government decided to bring them home, and they pinned a medal on the chest of one of the terrorists. And one of the terrorists is actually now working for a firm in America that sells small arms to various armies, including the United States and, oddly enough, New Zealand. This was revealed recently on Democracy Now. And sorry, I don't know which episode it is because I'm so far behind in listening to them that I actually haven't heard that yet. That was just on the news here recently. So the French got what they wanted by applying trade pressure on New Zealand. If the United States had applied trade pressure, I believe that they would have succeeded in getting New Zealand to back down, or at least to modify the policy in a way that it was effectively the same thing as repealing it. However, the Reagan administration wasn't that bright. They just wanted to stand up and be tough and all that sort of stuff. And to the neocons that ran the Reagan administration, there was nothing worse you could do than to stand up to the United States. Now, in today's New Zealand Herald, there was actually an excellent column by one of their columnists, John Armstrong. The title of it was Nuclear Free and Still Proud of It, and I'm going to put a link in the show notes. But there's a little bit of it that he said that I think pretty well sums all this up, and so I thought I'd just read that little bit of it. The context is he's talking about how the governments that succeeded the Lange Labour government realized that they couldn't repeal the policy, because even though there were certain areas in which it didn't really do what it was setting out to do, like, for example, if a ship carrying nuclear waste entered was in strife at sea, it would have to be allowed to enter New Zealand waters under international law. And there's really nothing that would prevent nuclear-powered or armed ships from sailing through Cook Strait, for instance. But be that as it may, it became part of New Zealand's psyche, its sense of identity and nationhood. And I think John Armstrong pretty well describes why and how that was. He says, "The law had become a symbol of the moment the nation came of age and threw off the last colonial shackles. After the Muldoon years of genuflecting to the White House and Whitehall, the anti-nuclear policy was the two-fingered salute of an obedient child-turned-stroppy teenager. That symbolism still glows with the intensity of fuel rods in a nuclear reactor politicians tamper with at their peril." And that's actually essentially the core of what the policy is. It has become wrapped up with the sense of nationhood for New Zealand and its sense of national identity in a global context. And so because of that, no party would sensibly consider ever trying to touch it, at least not for the foreseeable future. The support for the nuclear-free policy is widespread and deep, and it cuts across political agendas. It doesn't matter if you're on the left or the right or the center, where you are. If you're a New Zealander, chances are you back that policy 100%. And that was demonstrated in the last election when the man who became leader of the National Party, a man named Don Brash, shortly after he became leader of the party, and the party's a conservative party, he went to Washington, D.C., and he met with various Republican members of Congress. And he said of the nuclear-free policy that when National became government, the nuclear-free policy would be gone by lunchtime. He later denied it, but there was plenty of evidence that he had said it. And that didn't sit well in New Zealand, and he had some months to try to downplay it and all that. And he kept trying to say, oh, no, we're not going to touch it. But at the same time, it's been documented that behind the scenes, he was maneuvering to make that one of the first things that they did when they took power. So as that became more evident, he tried to weasel out of that as well. And he tried to convince people that they had no intention whatsoever of trying to touch the nuclear-free policy. People weren't buying it. And in the end, it's one of the factors that led to National's defeat in the last election. Because although the polls had been showing them doing really, really well, and even possibly becoming the next government, that, among a couple of other things, including some deals they did with the right-wing fundamentalist secretive Christian sect that's sometimes been referred to as a weird cult, all of that combined defeated the party. And the current leader seems to have gotten that message loud and clear, because he has stated that the nuclear-free policy will not be touched if National wins in the next election. We'll see. But the point, basically, is that no party could realistically expect to alter that policy now unless it really didn't want to be the party of government, because New Zealanders just don't support that issue. And it is so important to New Zealanders that I can't count the number of people who told me in the last election that if National got in and tried to repeal it, that they would go into downtown Auckland carrying signs and protesting at it. And these are people who wouldn't be seen at a protest to save their mortal souls. So maybe that gives you some idea of how closely held this policy is for ordinary New Zealanders. Now, I have missed out on a lot of comments because of the various breaks, both for the holiday and the fact that I screwed up. And I go over comments because I'm aware that there are people who never go to my blog, just as there are people on my blog never listen to the podcast. So what I've always done is I reply in writing to the commenters on the blog. And then, as you know, I read the comments and my comments here on the podcast. And basically, the whole point of this for me is that I'm trying to engage as many people as possible in a conversation about things that are going on and about the things that we talk about. And that's part of why I read the comments is because I want to encourage more comments, and I want to encourage people to comment back and to develop this dialogue and a conversation. Now, some podcasters think that people are perfectly capable of going to the blog and reading the comments themselves, and obviously they can, and some people do. But as I say, most of the people who listen to a podcast, not just mine, but any podcast, never go to read show notes or the site that talks about the podcast. So the only way they're going to know what the comments are is if, in my case, if I read the comments. Now, as a general rule, I don't read emails. And the reason for that is because I consider it to be more of a personal communication between me and the person sending the email. From time to time, I may share little bits and pieces. Usually, I will clear that in advance with whoever the person is. And if that's not possible, I would just not say who they are. I might just read a paragraph or something. But as a general rule, I don't read anything from emails. If there's something that you want to say and you don't want other people, if you read it to other people, send it to me in email, amrins@yahoo.com. And I don't read those on my podcast. So, having said all that, I'm going to go all the way back to episode 13. And first up is Archer, who says, thanks for the birthday wishes, because I said that first in that episode. You probably don't remember anymore. Anyway, he says, it's fun to see where my podcast shows up on iTunes, but I'm really not concerned about it. There was a time when I wanted to be on top and get lots of comments, but it just doesn't interest me anymore. I really just enjoy doing the podcast. If you're unable to have a podcast on Friday, I will miss it, because I had said that because of the weekend holiday and all that, I might not be able to do one on Friday. So I responded, well, I can now reveal that I was actually working on a mini mashup of Marilyn Monroe singing Happy Birthday to You, but my PC software with its limited functionality, or is it limited user knowledge, it meant I just couldn't make it work, especially not with the little time I had available. The thought was there, though. I'm more curious about the iTunes thing than anything. It's more of a sort of, that's interesting, kind of thing. By recording early like you do, like Archer does, I was able to post a Friday episode. How do you do it? I kept getting confused about days and things. The whole iTunes thing I was talking about, where I was showing up as a podcast of note or whatever they call it, or new and noted, I can't remember now. And I do just think it's interesting. I don't have the slightest idea how iTunes works and how it figures out its statistics, so I don't really care that much, to be honest. It would be nice to be famous and all those sorts of things in the podcasting world, but I'm not really expecting that, and that's actually not why I'm doing it. So, take it or leave it, I don't know. Anyway, Calvin says, you poor dear, it's bad enough that you have to try and understand that insane accent, and now it's getting worse. Those young hooligans are always trying to make things difficult. I'm glad that it sounds like you've arrived at a more stable place. I'm sad to see you've made yourself a MySpace page. It's strange how I've never felt that way about coworkers. They've almost always been women or faggots, and we always got along. Hope the visit with the family goes well, so I said. The thing is, after all these years, I actually understand the Kiwi accent, even the occasional odd one. I suppose mine would fall into that sort of category now. MySpace, yes. Well, I have no idea what to do with it. I basically just dual post my show notes. There are my show notes there, and post bulletins to my MySpace friends when I post a new episode. Other podcasters are doing it, so I did, but I really have no idea whether there's any benefit to me or not. And if any of you have any suggestions as to what I can actually use MySpace for, I'd be more than happy to get them, because, as I say, I just don't know what to use it for. It seems to be this big thing. I mean, so is Facebook, but Facebook seems even more useless to me. But that's me. I mean, maybe I'm just missing the point or something. I don't know. Anyway, I go on. I always get along with women co-workers and the faggots when there are some. Jeez, I can't even write in my own comments. Anyway, there aren't any that I know of at the company where my part-time job is, though logic dictates that there must be some somewhere. My problem is with older men who have been there for 15 to 25 years. They've become bitter and grumpy, and they're paid too well to move on. Those golden handcuffs. Oh, well, doesn't really affect me anymore. And, I'm hoping that this whole part-time job thing is going to be over soon, but we'll see. Condo Blogger says, Howdy, Arthur. I got a kick out of the fact that you had watched the CBS Evening News. Poor Katie Couric is having a tough time getting people in the U.S. to watch. I bet you'd be happy to know she has viewers, at least one anyway, in New Zealand. Happy to leave your review at iTunes. I just have to remember what my username is. I've only left one other, and that was in an effort to win something, of course. he often has little contests and things going on. If you go to his blog, there's a link on my site. He often has a reference to some sort of contest or competition or something, which I think is quite funny. Anyway, I responded. I usually watch ABC World News Tonight, which is on a pay TV at 12:30 p.m., a couple hours or so after broadcast in the U.S. I have my lunch while I watch that. If I miss it, the CBS Evening News comes on at 1:30 p.m., and on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, that's followed by question time in the New Zealand Parliament. And that's my routine, which it generally is. Except, of course, these days, on Wednesdays and Thursdays, I'm at the part-time job, but that's a whole nother matter. Adam from This Boy Elroy said, The iTunes featuring thing is so wonky and random. I know that the rankings, which fluctuate regularly, are based on how many people subscribe in a given hour, I think. Aren't stats addictive? I can only think of this when I hear that song. And in the comments, he has a link to a French and Saunders video on YouTube where they're doing an opera version of Lucky, 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 and it's absolutely hilarious. If you haven't seen it, you should go to my... sort of convoluted, but go to my blog and click on the link, or you can just go to YouTube and do a search for French and Saunders, or maybe Lucky, 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 even. But it is hilarious, especially like the part in the beginning where they're going through a buffet and Dawn French is piling her... plate high for food, and she's going, it's for my throat. But no, it's very funny. And I responded, stats are addictive. You've compared comments to crack. Well, stats would be an even stronger drug. I don't get the whole iTunes ranking thing, but I did note that today Calvin's podcast is the 7th most popular in the society and culture grouping on Podomatic, and mine was 9th. His is also 7th overall in the category, and mine is 14th. Those numbers are a little more relevant to me since they reflect downloads of Podomatic-hosted podcasts. And I actually looked at that yesterday again, and no, I'm not obsessed by it. It's just happened to be on Podomatic, and I just thought I would look and see. And both of us had moved up a bit. I think Calvin was at 6 and I was at 8 or something like that. But in the personal journals section, Calvin was number 1 and I was number 3. And between us was a podcast that hasn't been updated since March of last year, so I'm not sure how really accurate those numbers are either. So I think I've sort of gone off this whole idea of numbers and statistics and all that sort of stuff. It's still fun, but it just doesn't seem to be terribly reliable, does it? Oh, well. Be that as it may. Now, for episode 14, which was my pre-recorded one, I had received a comment which was actually more about episode 13, so I'm going to read these out of order. It's from Jason in D.C., who is a close and personal friend of mine, and I strongly urge you to go see his blog. He writes about all sorts of different things, about life in Washington, D.C., about things in the news, about things going on in his life, all sorts of different things. And since we've known each other for, let's just say it's been more than a few years, I've, of course, find it interesting, but I think that the diversity of things that he talks about makes his blog really interesting. And it's jasonsviewfromdc.blogspot.com, but there's a link on my site, and I'll try to remember to put one in the show notes as well. So he said, I agree with a lot of what you said. Wouldn't it have been great if the November election had caused George to go? But it didn't. I think the Democratic Congress has done some things. The investigation into the Attorney General would never have happened under the Republicans. Also, the Democrats will continue to push on the war, which is a good thing. September now seems to be the month when things come to a head. Of course, we'll only know if that's the case when September arrives. And I said, well, I certainly voted against Bush. Not that it really helped. Kerry would have won Illinois without my vote. Still, under a parliamentary system, Bush would be gone now. I've been critical of the Democrats, many of whom are Demo-publicans, people who call themselves Democrats but who vote like Republicans, in part because I want to see a U.S. party that acts differently from the Republicans, not just one that has a different name. However, I'm glad they're investigating the Attorney General, but until that moron is gone, their job isn't done. As for the Dems pushing the Bushies on the war, big deal. Bush won everything he wanted. The Dems got nothing but the opportunity to wag their finger at the Bushies. Meanwhile, Americans and Iraqis alike are still dying in Iraq's civil war, and nothing has been done to put even modest controls on the imperial presidency. My bet? September will arrive, Bush will change nothing, and Congress will do nothing about it. I hope I'm wrong. And we'll see. I'm not optimistic about everything, I have to admit. And I actually didn't really expect that the Democrats were going to be able to put controls on Bush. They just don't have the numbers, because even though they have a majority in the House, there's still a conservative majority in the House, and they're not going to be doing the right thing. They're going to do the neocon thing instead. I just wish that the Democrats would act a bit more like Democrats and a little bit less like Republicans. But I'm actually going to come back to that a little bit at the end of this podcast. And I mentioned in passing there, I said that I've been critical of the Democrats. That was actually in a post I put on my blog. And if you haven't been reading my blog, why the hell not? No, seriously. On my blog, I've been getting really stroppy lately about political things, especially about things going on in America, because I'm just getting so pissed off and fed up at the Bushies and their unrelenting stupidity. So if you want to see a whole bunch of rants, which are incredibly well written and researched. well, probably not. But if you want to see my rants on the subject of the Democrats and the Bushies and various other things, you can have a look on my blog, amarins.blogspot.com, and just look through some of the ordinary posts that aren't related to podcasts. So, going on about episode 14, Archer said, "Does Republican mean the same thing in New Zealand as it means here in the States? It's always nice to have a day off. Happy Queen's birthday holiday. As usual, I love the ending music." And I said, "Republican definitely does not mean the same thing in New Zealand as in the U.S. Here, it merely means the opposite of monarchist. It means one who backs a republic over a monarchy." And then I said, "The holiday is nice to have." The closest party in New Zealand to the Republican Party in America would be the National Party, except that the National Party is far more centrist than the Republican Party in America is. We don't have the right-wing Christian element interfering in politics as America does. There is a theoretically centrist party called United Future New Zealand, which has a Christian contingent in it, because it was merged from United Future and a party called United New Zealand, the United Party. Future New Zealand, whatever it was called. Anyway, it was originally called the Christian Democratic Party, and they failed to win any seats in the first MMP election in Parliament, which is 1995. And someday I'm going to try to explain this whole electoral system. But they went defunct, and they eventually merged with the United Party to form United Future New Zealand. And but most of those people aren't, you know, frothing at the mouth fundamentalists. The frothing of the mouth fundamentalists are all outside of Parliament. They've never been able to get elected. And so the National Party is more like a traditional conservative party. It's loaded with neocons, like the Republican Party is, but they don't have the theological and fundamentalist aspects to them, so it's not quite as icky as the Republican Party can be. But just for purposes of illumination, and so you know what you're dealing with, in New Zealand terms, I'm a supporter of the Labour Party. I'm a member of the New Zealand Labour Party, as a matter of fact, and I volunteered for them in the past. And I may end up working in the next campaign as well. And if so, there would be some good stories to tell, I imagine. In American terms, I'm a Democrat. I was raised in a Republican household, and the first vote I cast, I think, was in a Republican primary. But I've never in my life voted for a Republican for president, and I can't imagine that I ever will. Which is not to say that I've necessarily voted for Democrats. There have been numerous occasions when I voted against the Republican, but not necessarily for the Democrat. It's a kind of a hold your nose and vote anyway sort of situation. And this also is something I want to talk about a little bit at the end of the comments section, so I think I'm going to hold off any further comment about that. Calvin said, "It's sad you guys don't seem to still have parties for every queen's birthday. I really know so little about what Queen Elizabeth has actually done, so I can't make any judgments on her. Although my excuse for a holiday is a good one, in my opinion, although any excuse for a holiday is a good one, in my opinion, you know how people drink Coronas and margaritas for Cinco de Mayo. Do people drink port on the Queen's birthday?" And I said, "I actually have no idea if there are still parties or not, though there probably are. We hardly ever see the gay paper, and I never think to look online to see what events are going on. But it's still a day off, which is always good. As for port, well, there are plenty of people who have that without an excuse." And they do. And the thing about the paper, there is a gay paper. I think it comes out every 2 weeks, if I remember correctly. It's not easy to get, oddly enough. It's distributed in gay bars and whatnot, gay establishments, but most of those are in the Auckland side of the bridge, and since we live in the North Shore side of the bridge, we just don't have access to it. And, I mean, the news stuff that it carries, you can get faster online anyway, and I just don't think to look to see what events and so forth are going on. But there you go. So thanks for your comments, everybody. I really do appreciate them, and by all means, leave more. I love comments. My blog is located at amarins.blogspot.com, and you can feel free to leave a comment at any time, or, as I said before, send an email to me personally at amarins@yahoo.com. And as a rule, I don't read those on my podcast. So if you want to share, I suggest leaving a comment on my blog. If you don't want to share, send an email to me personally. And I won't mention you by name. It'll be a little secret. Now, I alluded to a couple of things a minute ago, and basically what it is that I wanted to talk about a couple of different podcasts. First, I listened to a two-part debate, and I use the term loosely, on The Occasional Fag, which I'd heard about through Archer's show. And essentially what the premise of the debate was is, would Michael Bloomberg, who's mayor of New York City, make a good candidate because he would be spending, a candidate for president, sorry, because he would spend his own money and not be beholden to the corporations. Now, unfortunately, a lot of the debate was not very helpful. There was a lot of partisan bickering, and there was a lot of point scoring on irrelevant things, I thought. But there were some valuable things that still came out of it in the end, I think. It's just that it was unfortunate that there was so much of people talking on top of other people. But I'm going to put a link in the show notes, and I would suggest you give it a listen, because it is an interesting question. If you haven't heard the story, the speculation is that Michael Bloomberg is considering running for president as an independent and will spend up to $1 billion, that's billion with a B, U.S. dollars on his effort. Now, I personally think that spending that kind of money is absolutely obscene, and there is no justification for it whatsoever. On the plus side, he, even with $1 billion with a B, he is not terribly likely to win if he runs as an independent. I mean, certainly history is not on his side. But you never know. Maybe $1 billion with a B could make a difference. I personally think he's a creep. But then he's, I don't know if he's as big a creep as Rudy Giuliani, but that's just me. I don't know. You might have a different opinion, which is fine. Leave it in the comments, and we can have a discussion. But seriously, it's good to hear that kind of lively debate going on, even when I don't always agree with a lot of the things that are being said. And one of the topics they were basically talking about was progressive, essentially. And the one guy, his name was John, I think it was making a lot of points that I thought were frankly absurd, and talking about essentially how all rich people are evil is what it boiled down to. And that's clearly not the case. I mean, I would love to be rich. It's unlikely to happen, but I would love to be rich. And I don't think that it automatically goes that just because somebody is rich that they're automatically an evil, maniacal, power-grabbing bastard. They could very well be perfectly decent human beings who are willing to play by the rules. The fact that there are evil, maniacal, power-grabbing bastards who are billionaires doesn't mean that they all are, I guess is what I'm saying. On the other hand, I also didn't agree with everything that Chef Mark was saying. He has an unwavering faith in the free market, which I just don't happen to share. And part of it is something I think that he would agree with me on, and that is that there's no such thing as a free market because of the interference of business of government regulations, primarily, but also some other factors as well. But my suspicion of the free market is that I think that more often than not, the prime motivation of business is simply greed. It's not maximizing profit. It's maximizing return to shareholders. And you might say to yourself, oh, that makes perfect sense because that's what a business is in business to do. But it is returning money to shareholders out of proportion to all logical return. It is money for money's sake. It is greed. Because it's damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead, screw the environment, screw the workers, screw everybody, just get your profits. And there's something inherently wrong with that. And in my worldview, government exists to rein in those greedy impulses and to make people be better than they otherwise would be. Now, in a perfect world, the market would regulate and it would get rid of the evil people, but it just doesn't happen in the real world because there aren't any free markets. Could we evolve in that direction? I don't know. I'm willing to hear those arguments. I just don't personally believe that at the moment. But that actually brings me to my next thing I wanted to talk about, which is a new podcast called Callbox 7. Now, I heard about this from Mike Hipp on podcastsoup.net, and I went to give it a listen. And I think it is fantastic. I can't recommend it highly enough. The guy is in Florida. I've forgotten where exactly, but he's in Florida. And he has done a series of shows. He's talking about things from a progressive point of view. Now, Mark had mentioned on the occasional fag how, to some people, the word progressive is pretty much the same thing as communist. And he was being a bit tongue-in-cheek, but I actually know where that attitude comes from, because I've encountered the same thing. And in my opinion, the word progressive has been co-opted by the left in the same way that the word conservative has been co-opted by fundamentalist Christians. You don't have to be a fundamentalist to be conservative, and you don't have to be a communist to be progressive. Now, in Callbox 7, one of the premises that he makes is that progressives are practical by nature, and they look for practical solutions to problems. Now, it is from a perspective that you do need government intervention, but it's not from the perspective of government is always best. And that show in particular about progressivism, I thought was fantastic. And I thought to myself, ooh, I'm going to end up quoting this show more than once. He has a really interesting and easy delivery. He cracks some jokes, he does some skits now and again, and he talks about the news and makes connections between things that you wouldn't think we're connected otherwise. It's a bit like Democracy Now! In that respect, except that it moves faster. And that's not a criticism of Democracy Now! Because I love Democracy Now! But it sometimes does plod along a little bit, I have to admit. So if you're looking for a new podcast to listen to, if you are interested in politics, especially politics of the more liberal perspective, then definitely you must listen to Callbox 7. I'll put a link in the show notes, and I'm actually going to add a link to my podcast lists, which I must get sorted out one of these days, because it's just such a fantastic show. I really can't recommend it highly enough. And that was actually all I wanted to say this week, catching up a bit on all the things that we've missed out on, and tell you a little bit about this whole nuclear thing on the 20th anniversary. Thank you very much for listening and for sticking with me through these rough patches over the past few weeks. Things, as I say, are getting better and getting more into sort of a normal routine. So thank you very much for listening. Thank you for downloading. Please leave a comment on my blog, amarins.blogspot.com, or send an email to amarins@yahoo.com, and I will talk to you on Tuesday. Really. Talk to you later. Oh, one last thing before I go. I forgot to say that the song that I sampled at the beginning of this episode is from a song called French Letter by The Herbs, which was a song protesting the French nuclear tests in the South Pacific. That's it, really. Talk to you Tuesday. Bye.